Phase 3. If we don't end war, war will end us. H.G. Wells. 22. Sitting there in the darkness, waiting for it all to just end, I found myself thinking about Lex. I wondered where she was and if she was still alive. Then I remembered my conversation with her and the QCOM hacks she'd shown me. My father's QCOM number was on my contact list. If he had the device in his flight suit, and if he hadn't powered it off, I might be able to use it to find his escape pod. Feeling a sudden burst of hope, I fumbled my QCOM out and pulled up my short contact list. Then I repeated the steps Lex had shown me to perform her remote location hack. It involved pressing several icons on my display in rapid order, like the old Konami code. It took me several tries to get it right because my hands were shaking and the hull integrity and leak warnings from my computer kept frazzling my nerves. Finally, a GPS program appeared on my QCOM's display. My QCOM appeared as a green dot, and my father's appeared right on top of it as a flashing red dot. I rotated the display to show our relative depths. My father's pod was directly below me. I blindly circled my ship around in a corkscrew, using my QCOM to close in on him. As I pulled up to avoid the tangled wreckage of two Glaive fighters, I felt a jolt and heard a loud crack as my father's escape pod appeared out of the watery darkness outside, slamming right up against my cockpit canopy. As the two acrylic domes collided, I caught a horrifying glimpse of his limp and lifeless face just a few inches from mine. It was covered in blood. Once I'd stopped screaming, I maneuvered my interceptor around his pod and activated its retrieval arm. A second later, its magnetic seals locked into place with a thud and the arm retracted, fusing my father's escape pod to the underside of my ship's hull. My computer linked to the pod's occupant diagnostics, and my father's vitals appeared on my HUD. He wasn't dead. He was merely unconscious, and the computer calculated a 67% chance that he had suffered a concussion. He was also bleeding from a deep laceration on his scalp. A dialogue box popped up on one of my cockpit screens, providing me with a running list of the treatment and drugs that the pod was administering to its occupant. A video window popped up on my display, showing my father's unconscious form from the shoulders up, and I winced as the pod dosed him with a cocktail of painkillers via a needle gun mounted on one of its many robotic arms. I hoped to hell the drugs in that pod didn't have an expiration date. I watched the drone work on him for a few more seconds. Then I finally snapped out of my daze and gunned my ship's throttle, blasting up out of the ocean, then on up into the clouds above, still flooring the gas. My computer informed me that my passenger needed medical attention immediately, and the autopilot set a course for my ship to the nearest EDA med center at the southern tip of South America. I ignored it. Instead, I flew us home. As I guided my interceptor over Portland's charred and smoking skyline, I felt tears come to my eyes. Here was my first glimpse of the devastation the Vanguard's attack had caused on our cities, and it was as bad as I'd feared. The whole city looked like a scene out of Deep Impact or World War Z. Every street, road, and highway leading out of Portland was clogged with all manner of vehicles, none of them moving. Pillars of black smoke rose from half a dozen fires all over the city, and the sky was filled with news helicopters and small-engine fixed-wing aircraft, most of which appeared to be fleeing inland. I tuned my QCOM to one of the big cable news networks so that I could listen in to the broadcast and heard the last thing I expected. In addition to the Earth Defense Alliance's decisive victory in Pakistan, one male news anchor was saying, news of dozens of other victories are pouring in from other cities around the world. The tide began to turn after the aliens' surprise attacks on Shanghai and Cairo. I frowned and switched to another network showing live coverage from New York City. The Big Apple looked just like it did in every apocalyptic disaster movie I'd ever seen. The skyline was a smoking ruin, and the streets of Manhattan had been flooded by a tsunami created by one of the many artificial earthquakes resulting from the attacks. Dozens of epic battles were raging over the city just moments ago, but as you can see, the skies are clear, another newscaster reported. The EDA's army of civilian-operated drones has won another decisive victory here. Humanity has successfully defended itself against the first wave of the invader's attack. We managed to fight them all off. It's incredible. The beautiful female anchor beside him nodded enthusiastically.
In every engagement we've had with the enemy so far, it has become obvious that humans are naturally more adept at combat than the creatures who are operating all of these invading ships and drones, she said. In every battle, they seem to have us outmatched. But, despite their vastly superior numbers and technology, the Europans appear to lack our reflexes and natural predatory instincts.
I switched news feeds again and saw Admiral Vance addressing the troops via his handheld QCOM, wearing his trademark expression of grim resolve. The man looked downright heroic.
But even though we managed to fight off the first wave of the invasion, we suffered heavy losses in the process, Admiral Vance said. The enemy didn't lose a soul, just equipment. And 2/3 of their forces are still en route to Earth.
He paused to let this sink in, then continued.
The second wave of their attack will reach us just over 2 hours from now, and we need all of you to be ready.
Just as he finished making that statement, a new countdown clock appeared on my QCOM display. Just over 2.5 hours to go until the second wave arrived, bringing twice as much devastation as the first. I switched to another channel, and then another, but it was the same war propaganda on every station. Newscasters of every nationality were claiming victory and imploring their viewers not to give up, to hunker down and keep on fighting because there was still hope we could still win this. I put my QCOM away, wishing that I could bring myself to rally to the Earth Defense Alliance's global battle cry. But it was obvious to me that our remaining forces wouldn't be able to withstand another assault of equal magnitude, much less 2 more attacks, delivered by a force of double and then triple the size of the first wave. I tried to forget about the news and thought again of my father's heroic act of self-sacrifice performed in the wake of Chen's kamikaze run. It shouldn't have worked, but it had, just as my father had predicted it would. I shouldn't need any more convincing. And I decided right then I didn't. I'm sorry I doubted you, Dad, I said to him over the comm link while I stared at his unconscious face on my monitor, his eyes closed and his forehead caked with dried blood. And I'm sorry I couldn't bring myself to call you Dad before now too, okay? Do you hear me? Do you, Dad? His eyes stayed closed, and he remained perfectly still. The ship's inertia cancellation field kept him from even being jostled slightly, even though we were flying through Earth's atmosphere fast enough to set the ship on fire. You were right and I was wrong, okay? I told him, raising my voice as if that would somehow help him to hear me. And I'd really like it if you would wake up now so that I can tell you that in person. Would you do that for me? Please? I said. General? Xavier? When he didn't answer, I tried again. Dad? But he still didn't respond. He was dead to the world. I flew him straight to the hospital in South Beaverton where my mother worked. But when I swooped down looking for a spot to land, I saw that all the roads surrounding it were jammed with abandoned vehicles and frightened people. If I landed my interceptor nearby, it would draw all kinds of attention, and it was doubtful I'd be able to take off again. I was circling back over the city, looking for a quiet place to set down, when I spotted my high school down below. There were only a few cars still parked in the student lot, and mine was one of them. I could still also make out the burn marks on the school's front lawn left by the EDA shuttle when Ray had arrived to pick me up this morning. A whole lifetime ago. I considered landing my ship in the lot right next to my car, but then I thought better of leaving it parked out in the open. A few seconds later, I spotted the perfect parking spot. I swung around and flew back over the school, but this time I strafed the roof of the gym with laser fire. Then I made another pass and strafed it again until the whole roof collapsed. Once the dust settled, I lowered my interceptor down into the gym, concealing it perfectly from view, except from directly above. The school superintendent was going to be pissed about the damage, but he could bill me. I was sure someone must have spotted my ship during its brief descent or heard the noise I'd made, But when I climbed out of my cockpit and ran back outside the gym to take a quick look around, I didn't see anyone rushing toward the building to investigate. I figured that the people who weren't too busy fleeing the city or looting were probably inside their homes, glued to their TV and computer screens, waiting for news. I sent my mother a text message asking her to meet us at home with a first aid kit as soon as possible. Then I pulled my car around, up to the gymnasium's exit. I ran back inside, opened up my father's escape pod, and, staggering under his weight, carried him out to my car. The jolt of pain he must have felt when I finally managed to flip him into the passenger seat brought him to a state of semi-consciousness.
"Rajive standing by," he said drunkenly, slurring his words.
He blinked a few times and looked around the car, his eyes widening in recognition.
"Hey, I know this car. This is my old Omni. This shit heap still runs?"
I couldn't speak for a moment. I was too overjoyed to see his eyes open. "Yeah, it still runs," I finally managed to say, "but just barely." As I gently removed his jacket, I noticed there was blood on some of its patches. I balled the jacket up and shoved it under his head for a pillow. "Try to stay still, okay? Just rest. We'll be home soon."
"Wow, really?" he said, smiling faintly. "I've never been home."
Luckily, my house was only a couple of miles from school, and most of the streets were still passable. I only had to make one detour to get around a five-car accident blocking an intersection. During the trip, my father drooled and mumbled in the passenger seat, obviously riding high on whatever pain meds the escape pod's emergency systems had injected into his bloodstream. As I turned down our street and saw our empty driveway, I clenched my teeth in disappointment. My mom wasn't here. I was still helping my father out of the car when I heard an engine behind me and turned to see my mom's car pulling in. I made a second's worth of eye contact with her through the windshield, saw her eyes widen as she recognized me. And then she was leaping out of her car and running to mine, covering her mouth with her long fingers. My father opened his eyes in the passenger seat beside me as she peered in. He didn't speak. He just stared at her, as if paralyzed. I put a hand on his shoulder. "Hey, Mom," I said, getting out of the car. "I'm home. We're home." She took me in her arms and crushed her face against my shoulder as tightly as she could. When she finally let go, she turned back to look at my father, still inside the car.
"Xavier?" she said. "Is that really you?"
Somehow he managed to pull himself up out of the car onto his feet. Then he took a step toward her and she threw her arms around him. He buried his face in her hair, inhaling deeply. As I watched them embrace there on the front lawn, my heart was rocked by waves of unbridled joy. It occurred to me that, up until this moment, I'd only ever experienced the bridled kind. Having the reins slipped off my heart after a lifetime of wearing them was a bit overwhelming, in the best possible way. I heard barking, and a second later, Muffet burst out of his doggy door. The old beagle barked and bounded down the front steps and across the front lawn, moving faster than he had in years.
"Muffet!"
my father cried, breaking off his embrace with my mother to greet the ancient dog, just a second before Muffet somehow summoned the strength to bound into my kneeling father's lap.
"Oh, it's so good to see you, boy,"
he said as Muffet showered his face with kisses.
"I missed you, boy. Did you miss me?"
Muffet barked happily in reply, then continued to shower my dad with saliva. It had never once occurred to me to wonder whether our dog remembered my father. After all, Muffet had just been a puppy when he disappeared. My father began to laugh under the beagle's barrage of kisses, but then he glanced over at my mother and me, and his features suddenly contorted into a mask of pain. He turned away and tried to hide his face by burying it in Muffet's graying coat. My mother put her arms around both of them, and I saw that there were tears running down her cheeks. And I knew that they were the same sort now welling up in my own eyes. Tears of joy. Through my increasingly blurred vision, I watched my father and my mother and my dog all holding each other just a few feet away from me. My family, impossibly reunited. after all this time. Suddenly, I wanted very much for the world not to end. I wanted it to keep going more than anything. My father set Muffet down and scratched his silvery muzzle.
You got old, didn't you, buddy?
That's okay.
I did too.
My mother examined the cut on my father's forehead and winced.
Help me get him inside, she said. Christ, what did you give him? Bourbon?
The med computer in his escape pod dosed him with some sort of painkiller, I explained. Will he be okay? My father burst out singing some old song I didn't recognize.
I haven't got time for the pain, he bellowed.
My mother let out a laugh, then nodded at me. He's definitely suffered a concussion, but yes, he'll live. She let out another laugh, which turned into a sob halfway through. That's funny, considering he's been dead for 17 years. She gave me an unsteady smile. Her lower lip was trembling. It's gonna be okay, Mom, I said, just to have something to say. We got my father into the living room and lowered him onto the couch. Then I turned to my mother and hugged her as hard as I ever had in my life. I need to run over to Deal's house, Ma, I told her, breaking off the embrace. There's something I promised Dad I'd do.
He didn't promise me anything, my father shouted, but his face was buried in the couch cushions and Muffet was sitting on his head, so I may have misheard him.
Zachary Ulysses Lightman, you are not going back out there, my mother said, pointing her finger at me. I've been worried to death. You can't do that to me again.
It's okay now, I told her as I headed for the door. The first wave of the invasion is over. Nearly all of the alien drones from the Vanguard have been destroyed. My mother smiled with relief, clearly mistaking my meaning. But that was just the first wave, Mom, I said. A lot more are on their way.
Two more whole waves of them, my father mumbled, lifting his head long enough to dethrone Muffet, then dropping it face first into the cushion again.
Her eyes shifted back and forth between the two of us uncertainly. I went over and hugged her a last time. I'll be back before then, I told her. I promise. I glanced at my father. Try and sober him up, will you? The drive to Deal's house was easier than I'd feared. I had to use some sidewalks and lawns to avoid pile-ups and down power lines, but there was no traffic, so the detours didn't take long. When I reached Deal's house, I saw over a dozen dormant aphids standing guard around the perimeter of his lawn like robotic sentinels. I saw the omnidirectional camera eyes swivel to follow me as I approached, but they made no move to stop me. I scaled Deal's backyard fence, climbed up onto his roof, and then tiptoed over to his second-story bedroom window to peer inside. To my relief, Deal was in there. He was alive, and he was doing exactly what I'd expected to find him doing, sitting at his computer, talking to Cruz via a video window on his computer. Deal had the soles of his feet propped against the edge of his desk, and he was leaning his metal chair back, balancing it on its two rear legs, an old habit of his. When I tapped on the window pane and he looked over to see me standing outside in my EDA uniform, he jerked backward in surprise. The chair tipped over and he fell to the floor with a thud. But he recovered quickly, scrambled back to his feet, and ran over to throw open the window.
Zach, he said, leaning out the window to give me a hug before pulling me inside. Jesus, man!
We hugged each other. Then I turned to wave at Cruz in his monitor. He was sitting at his computer in his own cluttered suburban bedroom just a few miles away.
Holy shit, I said. It's really good to see both of you guys. Yeah, we had no idea what happened to you, Cruz said. Sweet EDA uniform.
Thanks, I said, collapsing into a beanbag chair in the corner, suddenly feeling the heaviness of my exhaustion weighing me down like a suit of medieval armor.
We weren't sure we'd ever see you again after you flew off in that shuttle, Deal said, sitting back down at his desk.
Oh, that reminds me.
He leaned over and punched me in the shoulder, hard.
Ow!
I said, recoiling as I raised my own fist to feign retaliation.
What the actual fuck, Deal?
That's for leaving without me, Biggs, he replied, leaning back. Don't ever do that again.
I sighed, rubbing the sight of my future bruise. Like I had a choice, I said, laughing. Asshole.
School was canceled right after you left, and they sent everyone home.
Cruz added. That's where we were when the news hit earlier this afternoon, so we jumped online and helped fight off the first wave. We've been glued to our consoles since, Deal said, still in shock. We helped defend Shanghai and Karachi until the disruptor activated and disabled everyone's links. We would have been hosed if the EDA hadn't taken that thing out.
The EDA's drone operator assignment system switched both of us to local defense once the enemy began to spread out and attack everywhere, Cruz continued. And since we're two of the highest-ranking drone drivers in the greater Beaverton area, we got first dibs on local drone access. We used our Aethids to help defend Beaverton from the drones that landed here.
Yeah, did you see that basilisk we took out? Deal asked. It was right down the street from your house.
You two did that?
They both nodded proudly.
We couldn't let that thing stomp your house,
Deal said, slapping me on the back and then hooking his arm around my neck. Thanks, fellas, I said. I appreciate it. I pointed back outside at the ring of Aethids encircling his house.
How did you manage that?
Their operating software has zero security installed, Cruz said. I guess the EDA decided not to bother, but that makes them incredibly easy to hack. People all over the world have been figuring out all sorts of hacks to make them do stuff the EDA never intended. Then they post how-to videos on YouTube showing everyone else how to do it, too. He pointed outside. That's how I disabled the recall subroutine on those Aethids out there, so they didn't leave for reassignment after the first wave. He beamed proudly. Now they'll be here to protect my mom and little sisters when the second wave arrives.
I nodded, impressed. I was about to ask if he tried making them line dance when Cruz shouted at me from the laptop screen.
So spill it, he said. What happened to you after that shuttle picked you up at school this morning? Where the hell have you been all day?
I considered how to answer.
On the far side of the moon, I replied. With my dad.
On the monitor, I saw Cruz's jaw drop open. To my left, Deal leaned back a few inches too far in his chair and fell over again.
Once I caught my breath, I tried calling Lex to make sure she was okay. She didn't answer, but a few seconds later, she texted me, I'm okay. We'll call you ASAP, Lesson 3. Then, as quickly as I could, I told the mics everything that had happened since we'd last seen each other. Eventually, I worked my way up to telling them my father's theory about the Europans' true motives and the observations he'd made that supported it. It took a while for me to get to our battle with the Disruptor and to explain how its conclusion seemed to be proof of my father's theory. When I'd finally laid everything out, I asked the question I'd come here to ask. What do you guys think? They both stared at me in silence for a long time. Deal was the first to speak.
I think your dad is probably right, he said.
Why would the Europans bother to send robots and spaceships to attack us? He shoved a handful of corn chips into his mouth, then chewed thoughtfully.
If their primary goal was to wipe out the human race, they could have just hurled an asteroid at Earth, or fired a bunch of long-range nukes, or poisoned our atmosphere, or maybe they're precursors, Cruz shouted from Deal's computer monitor. Maybe they seeded life on Earth millions of years ago, and now they're here to punish us for turning out to be such a lame species and inventing reality TV and shit.
He raised an index finger.
Or maybe they're omnipotent beings who have grown bored with immortality, and they're just tormenting us for their own twisted amusement, you know? Like whenever Q would pop in from the Continuum to fuck with Picard.
This conversation was an intelligent one right up until you joined it, Deal said. I didn't chime in. I just let them debate the issue as if we were all back in our high school's cafeteria arguing some trivial facet of pop culture over cardboard pizza. This was why I'd come here, I realized, to get the opinion of my two most trusted friends, gauge their reaction, and see if their conclusions mirrored my own. And in a way, they did. They seemed to be just as confounded by all of this as I felt, and yet were also just as intrigued by the mystery as my father. I checked the time. It was still running out, and I realized that I'd already made my decision.
I appreciate you talking through this with me, fellas, I told them. Now I've got a phone call to make.
I raised my wrist and activated my QCOM. Both of my friends' eyes lit up.
What the holy sweet hell is that? Deal asked. A tricorder?
Finn Arbogast answered after the third ring, and his smiling face appeared in high-definition video on my QCOM's display.
Judging by the view behind him, he was sitting in some sort of command bunker with giant display screens bolted to its thick concrete walls, each displaying icon-littered maps of various regions of the world.
"Zack," he said, "I'm glad to see that you're alive. You and your father were reported missing in action just after you took out that disruptor. Congratulations, by the way. I watched the whole thing."
"Then you know that my father just risked his life to save us all," I said. "So I think you owe him a favor, don't you?" He smiled uneasily. I waited for him to ask about my father, but he said nothing.
"Did my father ever tell you his theory about the Europans' true motives?"
His smile vanished, and he let out a heavy sigh.
"You mean his theory that this invasion is all a ruse?" Arbogast said. "That the Europans orchestrated this whole conflict as some sort of test for humanity?"
"Yes, I know all about it."
"I'm sorry, Lieutenant. Your father is a great man, a hero, and we all owe him a huge debt. But all these years at war have addled his brain. He's become delusional."
"No, he hasn't," I replied, too forcefully. "I've seen the evidence myself. When we were going up against the disruptor in Antarctica, it dropped its shield on purpose. They let us destroy it. Look at the footage. You can see it happen for yourself." He didn't respond, but his eyes shifted evasively. He looked as if he spent most of his time in front of a computer instead of with people, and he wasn't used to being interrogated or put on the spot like this.
"I don't see the point in this conversation," he said. "We debated all of this with your father years ago, and I'm not going to go through it again now with you, kid. I mean, look around you. Our enemy's motives are obviously no longer in question." He pointed to the giant map of the world behind him. "The Europans just killed over 30 million people, and that was just the first wave of their invasion. The second wave is arriving just over an hour from now, so if you'll excuse me, I need to prepare for it. Sir, if you'll just let me speak to someone who..."
Before I could say another word, he ended the call. I lowered my phone and turned to look at my friends.
"Okay," Deal said, leaning forward. "That was a giant ball of fail. What now?"
I smiled and held up my QCOM. All the names I'd just lifted from Finn Arbogast's phone were listed there. I scrolled down to highlight the one labeled Armistice Council Members, Conference.
"He already gave me all the help I need," I said.
"You hacked his future phone?" Deal said. "How? You can barely use apps."
"If you must know," I said, "that super hot mech driver I met at Crystal Palace showed me how to do it. She also kissed me, FYI.
"Really?" Cruz said, laughing. "Is she from Canada? The Niagara Falls area, perhaps?"
"I want to know if they boned in zero gravity," Deal said. "Spill it, Lightman."
I ignored their questions and called my father on his QCOM. It rang and rang. As I continued to let it ring, I grabbed Deal's phone off his desk to dial my mother's number, only to discover that it was already programmed into his contacts as Pamela Lightman.
"Why did you have my mom's number saved in your phone?"
"Oh, you know why, Stifler," Cruz muttered from his video window, his voice dripping with innuendo. This was his version of "That's What She Said."
"I've had your mom's number in my phone since I was 12, psycho," Deal said. "You have my mom's number in your phone, too. Get over yourself."
I nodded, then shook my head vigorously. "Sorry," I said. "Sorry, man." I put his phone to my other ear. My mother's number rang and rang, too, while my father's continued to ring in the other. A minute passed. Neither of them picked up. Probably not good. I wondered if my dad's condition had gotten worse, and she'd decided to take him to a hospital after all. After Crom knows how many rings, I finally gave up and canceled both calls. Then I pulled up Arbogast's contact for the Armistice Council again and tried to make a decision. I badly wanted to have my father on the line before I called them. The Armistice Council would be made up of world-renowned scientists or EDA commanders or both, and they probably wouldn't listen to some 18-year-old kid. But there was a good chance my father was unconscious and the clock was ticking down. What choice did I have? I summoned my courage and tapped the Armistice Council contact on my QCOM. I watched as the device dialed five different numbers all at once, and then connected all of them simultaneously. Then, my QCOM switched into conference mode, and my display screen was divided into 5 separate windows, each containing live video of a different person, each of whom appeared to be in a separate location. There were 4 men and 1 woman, and all of them looked familiar to me, but I only recognized 2 of them by name, the 2 men whose faces appeared in the last 2 video windows on my screen. The first was Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, and the second was Dr. Stephen Hawking, slumped in his motorized wheelchair. I heard Cruz and Deal gasp behind me just as my own jaw dropped open like a castle drawbridge. Dr. Hawking spoke up first. I saw the familiar heads-up display for an aphid on the computer monitor behind him. It appeared that Dr. Hawking had been helping defend Cambridge from its alien siege when he answered the call. He spoke using his famous computer-generated voice, which now, ironically, reminded me of Chen's translator instead of the other way around. "Who are you?" he asked. "And how did you get this number?" I opened my mouth to answer, but no words came out. I'd just recalled the names of the 3 other scientists on the call. I'd seen each of them interviewed on countless science programs and documentaries. The Asian gentleman was Dr. Michio Kaku, and the other 2 people were famous SETI researchers, Dr. Seth Shostak and Dr. Jill Tarter. I recognized Tarter because she was a former colleague of Carl Sagan's, and she'd served as the primary inspiration for Jodie Foster's character in the film Contact. I was on the phone with 5 of the world's most prominent scientists, and they were all waiting for me to say something. "Dr. Hawking asked you a question," Dr. Tyson said, rolling his eyes slightly. "This is not a good time to be wasting our time." I shook my head and forced my voice into action. "I'm sorry, sir, of course," I said, clearing my throat. "My name is Zach Lightman. I was stationed at Moonbase Alpha with my father, General Xavier Lightman, until it was hit, and the fate of human civilization depends on what I have to tell you." They all stared at me, waiting. I told them, as quickly and succinctly as I could, everything my father had told me, along with what I'd seen for myself in our last disruptor battle. To my shock, none of them hung up on me. So I kept talking until I had told them everything, and probably a few things more than once. I also used my QCOM to transfer the data my father had obtained from Arbogast, including all of the raw Envoy mission footage and the transmissions we'd received from the Europans. It only took a few seconds before they were each scanning the data on their own QCOMs. "Some of the things you've just told us are extremely unsettling," Dr. Tyson said. "But unfortunately, they're not entirely surprising. Since it was first formed, this council has encountered a fair amount of secrecy and military bureaucracy in our dealings with the Earth Defense Alliance Command, especially pertaining to the release of classified information about the Europans. We were never given unrestricted access to that data."
"Lieutenant, would you mind if we put you on hold a moment?" Dr. Tarter asked, "so that we can discuss the information you've just given us in private?"
"Sure," I said, glancing at the countdown clock in the corner of my display, now ticking off the remaining minutes until the second wave attacked. "Take all the time you need. It's not like the world is about to end." I don't think they even heard my snarky reply, because they put me on hold before I'd finished making it. Their video stream windows froze and grayed themselves out. I also noticed tiny arrow icons linking their 5 video windows to indicate that they were all still talking to each other on the call while I was temporarily excluded. That was when Cruz caught a glimpse of my QCOM screen, which was now divided into over 6 windows, each with a different person's face, just like the opening of the Brady Bunch. So he decided to belt out an impromptu parody of the opening line of the show's theme song. "This is the story of an alien invasion by some fuckheads from Europa who are..." That was all he managed to get out before Deal snapped his laptop shut, cutting him off. He winced at me apologetically. "It's okay," I told him. "The council has me on hold." Deal exhaled and reopened his laptop. Cruz was still singing away. "All of them have tentacles, like their mother, the youngest one in curls." Deal laughed. Cruz laughed. I laughed. Gallows humor.